This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. On today's show, glyphosate Roundup. The facts are coming to light on the most widely used farming chemical since water, glyphosate, made famous as the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup, an herbicide we are all familiar with. It's literally all over America. It can be found in our food, in the rain, and inside our own cells. In the first of two episodes on this ubiquitous substance, we'll learn how it came to be such a major part of our food system and how it is affecting farmers and consumers across the Midwest and around the world. Host Dave Bennett Freeling interviews Craig Volin of the Kansas Sierra Club and Carrie Gillum, journalist and author of Whitewash, the Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. But first, the environmental news for the week of April 29th, 2019 on Eco Radio KC. My name is Ebony Johnson. Democracy Now! Reports, around the world, climate activists with the group Extinction Rebellion concluded 10 days of civil disobedience last week. Over the past 10 days, more than 1,100 activists have been arrested as part of the Extinction Rebellion protest. Among those arrested was a man who marked his 83rd birthday by climbing onto the roof of a train. An alarming new report published in the journal Nature Communications finds that without immediate action to curb greenhouse gas emissions, melting Arctic permafrost could add as much as $70 trillion to the overall economic impact of climate change. A draft United Nations report reveals up to 1 million species are at imminent risk of extinction due to human behavior. The report, which is set to be released on May 6, warns the accelerating loss of clean air, drinkable water, and biodiversity poses the threat. In South Africa, at least 33 people are dead after floods and mudslides crushed homes around the city of Durban. Some parts of South Africa have received over more than three times the average monthly total for all of April. BBC News reports the UK Shell Gas Commissioner is resigning after just 6 months, saying fracking is being thwarted by rules preventing many earthquakes. UK current government rules require fracking to be suspended every time a 0.5 magnitude tremor is detected. The Shell Gas Commissioner said the cautious approach to tremors had created a de facto ban on fracking. A spokesperson for the government said it was confident that current regulations strike the right balance in ensuring the fracking industry can develop, while ensuring all operations are carried out safely and responsibly. National Geographic reports, a whole community plans on reusing or recycling every scrap of waste on the Danish island of Bornholm. Garbage sorting, recycling, minimizing waste, and new technology are the tools envisioned to turn Bornholm into one of the first garbage-free communities on the planet, as the island's only waste incineration facility is wearing out. The bold decision was made last December to close it down in 2032 and make the transition towards a garbage-free society. NPR reports, following a recent setback in court and months of pushback from coastal communities, the Trump administration is postponing its plans to greatly expand oil and gas drilling off the nation's coast. Dozens of people gathered on the plaza in Kansas City on Saturday for the local chapter of Extinction Rebellion, Funeral for Our Future, which included a funeral march through the plaza. Here is an excerpt from activist Val Inglom's Eulogy for Our Future.
Indeed, Mother Earth has provided us with a great many things. A few of us individuals have attempted to return the favor by recycling our waste, planting trees, placing solar panels on our homes, but in the end, it wasn't enough. Corporations still ravaged her inside and out. Government still rested quietly as it happened, and not enough of us came together in the end that were seen enough. But my friends and family, weep not for the passing of this life which gave us life. Weep not for what we could have done differently, because that time has passed. And weep not for your children. We are given a wondrous opportunity to create a new Earth. Scientists say we have 10 years before the point of no return. This is our chance to use the next 10 years to create life from death. But it takes action. So go on into this world. Take your time to mourn for the passing of our mother, who selflessly provided so much, but repay her memory by working together to form a new world, a new earth, and a new way of life for our children and their children. We are better when we work together.
Activist Val Engelholm speaking at Saturday's event, Funeral for Our Future. Look to Eco Radio KC's Facebook page for live video of the event. For KKFI, I am Ebony Johnson.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For 5,000 years, structures from a Stone Age village have survived on the rugged coast of Scotland's Orkney Islands.
Skara Brae is very well preserved. Things like bones survive, and also the furniture within it was made out of stone. So you can see beds and the hearth around which the people would have sat.
That's Jane Downs of Scotland's University of the Highlands and Islands. She says Skara Brae is just one of the island's many archaeological sites at risk of being destroyed by climate change.
We're seeing increasing sea levels and so more inundation, but also the increased storminess and increased rainfall. So there are these factors which combine to make the sites incredibly vulnerable and actually suffering erosion at a measurably increasing rate.
Down says building barriers, such as stone walls, might provide protection for some vulnerable sites, but it's too expensive and time-consuming to do so for all. And when places like Skara Brae are destroyed, that history can never be recovered.
It's giving us aspects of life 5,000 years ago that you don't get anywhere else.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and good evening, everyone. And I'm kind of I'm an impromptu person on the phone. I did this last week on the program, and I brought in our guy from Green for All out of Oakland, California. Michael, you on the line?
Hey there, Richard.
Hey, buddy. Hey, it's just 2 weeks in a row. We got to stop meeting like this, huh? Say, look here, I want you to go ahead and give your pitch on this program we're going to have tomorrow, this video launch party that we're doing, and kind of bring people up to spiff on what we're doing, okay?
Yeah, sure thing. So, hey, everybody, my name is Michael Estrada. I'm the organizing director with an organization called Green for All. And first thing I want to suggest folks do is go check out Fuel Change Now.com. FuelChange Now.com. That'll take you over to our website, and it'll give you all the information you need about our campaign that we're currently running called Fuel Change. So what we're doing is we're mobilizing a movement of people across the country to work towards climate change and improve health by bringing zero-emission electric vehicles, trucks, and buses to their neighborhoods. We know that transportation is the number one source of carbon emissions in the U.S., and we know that that's a leading cause of climate change. So as I just heard somebody mentioning now, you know, scientists by some reports are telling us that we're roughly a decade away for irreversible damage. So what we want to make sure that we're doing is we're lifting up one of the leading industries in the country as far as contributing to climate solution. So what we're doing is we're looking at transit and all the different ways that people are affected by it negatively. So whether that's dirty diesel buses that are taking your kids to school, whether that's people in certain communities that are living out in further rural areas not having the same kind of transportation options available to them or the same kind of bus routes available to them, et cetera. And what we're doing with this campaign is we're empowering people to both learn about the issue, see themselves within the movement, and then take action themselves on how they can bring some of these solutions to their community. We're working with the school district in Sacramento, California, on helping them bring 100% electric school buses to their district. We're working with a region of states throughout the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast that's looking at improving and implementing some regional policy laws, transit policy laws that are put in an equitable way, amongst many others. So what we want to do is we want folks to take the first step by visiting fuelchangeanthem.com. It'll give you a chance to see our music video, which was called The Fuel Change Anthem, which was hosted after a nationwide contest for different artists to submit, and we're really proud of the music video itself. You know, we have some young artists from across the country that are talking a bit about how they've been impacted by transit pollution themselves. The video pulled off over 500,000 hits in the first month, which we're very proud of the momentum that we have going for there. And then really excited for the folks that are local listening to this program. Richard's a part of the group that's working with Green for All to set up a watch party in your own community now, where you'll have a chance to screen the music video, walk through some discussion around how your own communities are impacted by some of these transit issues, and begin thinking through, you know, what does a healthy solution to that look like for you. And so really what we want to do, and I'm sure, Richard, you can give sort of the specific details on the event itself, but we're really excited to have people come out and check out the music video, begin this conversation, and really start figuring out what are the next steps that they can do in their own communities to bring some of these clean solutions like electric buses, vehicles, et cetera.
Oh, you do outstanding, Michael. I want folks to know this is going to be held at Metro Energy Center, which is at 31 West 31st Street in Kansas City, Missouri. And Metro Energy has teamed up with a group called Poetry for Personal Power. And they're going to have some spoken word people there. That's going to have a young lady named Serenity. And she has put together some poetry that she's going to do for us here on the local level. So we're looking forward for folks that are really interested and concerned about the air that we're breathing. I love the fact that it's dealing with folks who live in the underserved communities, that where we have a lot of our problems. And I'm hoping that we will get folks out to come out to hear this video that has been done. I've listened to it. I think they did a fantastic job. I'm going for the younger group that's also come out to have a chance to see, because they are the ones that are suffering the consequences of this bad air that we're breathing. So, Michael, I'll let you finish it up there with just a little bit more, and then we out of here.
Thank you very much, Richard. So, yeah, once again, you can go ahead and check out fuelchangenow.com. That's fuelchangenow.com. And stay tuned. Like we said, some of the actions you can take is watch the video, share it with your folks in your community, friends and family, attend the event that Richard just mentioned once again. And then coming up very soon, we're going to be releasing some new content for people to have a chance to take this a step further and start bringing some of these solutions, like we mentioned, to their own community.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot. Now, that's going to be tomorrow night, folks, from 6 to 8 at 31 West 31st Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you.
Cheers, Richard. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
All right. This is Dave Bennett Freeling, and we'll be back after just another brief message with an interview with Craig Voland about glyphosate, and learn more about this important chemical that is super pervasive and all around us, and that's getting more and more press these days. So we're just going to touch on that and then maybe finish up with, we'll move on to an interview with an author from Kansas City who's also focusing on this issue, and then finish up with a little brief news on what's new in glyphosate. And stay tuned for that.
You never know what you're going to hear on Radioactive Magazine. We might be discussing racism or climate change or Palestinian rights or a dozen other social justice issues, featuring interviews by activists from ACLU, Indivisible KC, Black Lives Matter, many more. Whatever the topic, we promise a thought-provoking discussion. That's Radioactive Magazine's Tuesday, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Craig Voland, you're the Agriculture and Air Quality Chair for the Kansas Chapter of the Sierra Club, and we've got you here to talk to us about this chemical called glyphosate. What's your background? How did you come to this interest in the environment and issues of agriculture?
Well, I have a degree in civil engineering. I was always interested in technologies, but over time became more and more interested in environmental issues, broad scale environmental issues, and worked for a time as a environmental consultant. Became active in the green movement, and then joined the Sierra Club in Kansas, and still spend a lot of my time helping people fight these big animal factories. They're called CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, and also working with consumers around Kansas City area on how to avoid the industrial food and patronize the local farmers that do it right.
So you're part of a long line of scientists turned advocates, and
right.
Because that's what happens. The more you learn about issues,
yes,
the more you want to help people out to protect them and care for people. That's great. Tell us about glyphosate. What have you learned over the years?
Well, the glyphosate is entwined with the development of genetically engineered crops. Recognized as a herbicide by Monsanto in 1970, in 1974, they gave it the Roundup label brand and started selling it as a herbicide. But Monsanto, which at that time was selling any manner of chemicals, including Agent Orange, for example, and also PCBs, many of the chlorinated hydrocarbons that were ultimately banned. So they were really a chemical company. So then you'd ask the question, well, why did they get into crops and food? Well, because they wanted to sell more chemicals. So when they started their signature chemical at the time became glyphosate or Roundup, they began selling it. And then in 1996, they invented this earlier, but in 1996, they introduced genetically engineered corn primarily and soybeans and other and cotton, and the whole idea was that you could spray these crops all season long after they had sprouted and not kill them. Well, this gave the opportunity to use huge amounts of more chemicals, and in fact, from 1996 to about a few years ago, the amount of glyphosate went up by a factor of 15. We're talking hundreds of thousands of tons. And because they also started using it to dry out or desiccate mature crops, so it was cheaper to harvest the fruit or the corn and stuff off of it, this meant that it was covering the product that went into the food supply, that it was couldn't be avoided. You're spraying the final product. So we now know, just in the last few years when scientists started looking into it, that almost our entire food supply is now contaminated by some level of glyphosate. Now, the claim that Monsanto has made from the beginning is that it's completely safe for humans because it works by inhibiting an enzyme that causes plants to form proteins and, in a sense, grow, and that this enzyme doesn't exist in humans. So that's the claim they've made. It couldn't possibly hurt humans. But what they didn't say is that there's indirect ways that it can get into humans and affect us. And in particular, just in the last 10 years, we've understood that our gut microbiome, which is what you think is nasty stuff in your gut, is actually your friends. That it is has previously unknown benefits to our health, our whole body, benefits from what these little bacteria and other microbes are doing in our gut. Now that glyphosate is all over our food supply, it's going through the gut. The other major area is because they were pouring so much glyphosate onto the fields that is now in all the soil. And so it operates on the bacteria and fungi in the soil to inhibit their activity, and they are crucial. This symbiotic relationship between our microbes and our bodies is similar to the symbiotic relationship between plants and the soil that they're in. It's crucial. The microbes do things that allow plants to take up nutrients they need. One of the other claims that Monsanto made from day one is that the best part of the reason for using glyphosate is that it replaces older, more toxic chemicals like 2,4-D, which is one of two chemicals in Agent Orange. They said, well, we'll just substitute this very safe chemical called glyphosate and Roundup. Well, there were scientists back in the beginning that said, if you use huge quantities of this chemical out there in the environment, the weeds are going to develop resistance. And they did, just exactly like was predicted. So now in just the last couple of 3 years, because the farmers are saying, well, what do we do now? This glyphosate doesn't work. And they kept putting more and more glyphosate on. So they said, okay, we've developed some new seeds for you. And they are resistant to 2,4-D and dicamba. So these are the old toxic pesticides that they claim were going to be eliminated are now going to have to be used in larger quantities. And both of them are very susceptible to spray drift. You may have, some of the audience may have read about farmers complaining or neighbors to farmers complaining about their trees being killed or their shrubs or whatever from spray drift from these two, dicamba and particularly dicamba, but also 2,4-D. This is a reason why Monsanto and now Bayer, who owns Monsanto, and they're kind of having indigestion right now on that, why there's so much skepticism of what the chemical industry says, because 20 years after they make these claims, they turn out not to be true. If you're interested sometime, you can go on the Kansas Sierra Club website and click on the, if you look at the issues, there'll be one that says industrial agriculture, and that's all my writing. So the other thing to look at is the Kansas City Food Circle website. So this is a long-term project of educating consumers to instead patronize the local farmers.
Well, I appreciate all the work that you've done with this, just educating people and encouraging people to find other means of having healthy food. So yeah, thank you for your information and thanks so much for your work on this.
Right.
The Great Lakes Observing System on this current cast. The Great Lakes are wonderful places for boating and fishing, but they can also be dangerous, so it's important to know the lake conditions before going out. Now, a system of near-shore buoys provides boaters with information about air and water temperature, wave height, currents, wind direction, and speed.
These are the basic properties of the lakes that a boater might use to decide whether or not the conditions were safe enough to take their boat on the lake.
Kelly Page is the executive director of the Great Lakes Observing System. She says the data is also used by weather forecasters to predict rip currents at beaches and is available for researchers. Find a buoy near you by searching greatlakesbuoys.org. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant. Online at currentcast.org.
Metropolitan Energy Center and Poetry for Personal Power are hosting a fuel change watch party to fight for breathable air in underserved Kansas City neighborhoods on Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. at 31 West 31st Street, featuring Serenity Speaks and Richard Mabian. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Dave Bennett Freeling with Eco Radio KC. And some of you may know that I'm a high school biology teacher in Kansas City. And recently, my students have been working on projects where they research an environmental problem, its causes, impacts, solutions, and some history. And as they're learning about history, I've introduced them to the 20th century events that are referred to as the Green Revolution. And the Green Revolution is a term that may sound sustainable and ecologically friendly to the uninitiated, but to those who have studied business and agriculture and history and science, it's something different entirely. Business people and farmers considered a monumental time of great success in taming the land with modern farming technology, and it's a valiant effort to feed the world. Historians can tell you that our worldwide rates of starvation have plummeted, and that relatively few people today live with the kind of desperate want for food that our ancestors suffered. And meanwhile, independent science has shown that this green revolution has led to exhaustion of soils, overuse of chemicals like fertilizers and pesticides, and high levels of cancer and other cellular diseases in farmers, agrochemical manufacturing workers, and some other issues with the state of farming today, like monoculture and the associated problems with that. So today, we'll be talking about some of the after effects of one aspect of the Green Revolution, which is the weed killers and the problems that are associated with those, with Carrie Gillum. And Carrie's on the line with us today. And Carrie currently lives in Kansas City. She's an investigative journalist and research director at U.S. Right to Know, and author of Whitewash, The Story of Weed Killer Cancer and the Corruption of Science. Welcome, Carrie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. How did you first learn about agriculture and the ways that chemistry's worked its way into modern agriculture?
Well, I was a banking reporter, actually, and I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, writing about financial issues and covering big bank stocks and Reuters, the international news agency that I spent most of my career with, asked me to move to Kansas and start covering food and farming and these new genetically engineered seeds that Monsanto and other companies were rolling out. This was in the 1990s. So I moved to Kansas and started getting, you know, digging in the dirt and traipsing my way through farm fields. I spent a lot of time with Monsanto and DuPont, Pioneer, Dow Chemical, Syngenta. So, you know, since the 1990s, my focus of my research, my reporting work has been on food and agriculture and the modernization that you spoke about, really the Green Revolution or the modernization of agricultural practices. And the ensuing controversy and the health impacts and the environmental impacts.
And initially, Reuters was interested in that just because of the success of this chemical and the influence it had on the development of genetically engineered crops and just the widespread use of this chemical. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, genetically engineered crops, you know, really got a lot of attention, and Monsanto and the others still to this day proclaim it's all about feeding the world. You know, and I didn't have any reason to doubt that when I first started my research and reporting, but it became clear pretty quickly within a couple of years that that wasn't really what it was about at all. It was really about encouraging the use of specific pesticides, specifically Roundup and other glyphosate based weed-killing chemicals, and helping Monsanto capture and control that market. You know, it's all laid out in their internal documents, and that's how it played out, and it's become a billion-dollar baby for them.
And who is using Roundup? Who kind of run through the type of people who would be applying Roundup?
Well, farmers are sort of the biggest segment of users that we talk about and we know about. It's Roundup. There are hundreds of products that use glyphosate now because Monsanto's patent has expired. But Monsanto remains sort of the largest player in the glyphosate-based herbicide market. And farmers are a key customer target for them. Roundup and other glyphosate products are used with genetically engineered crops, soybeans and corn and cotton and canola and sugar beets and alfalfa. But the company has also marketed this for use on things like wheat and oats and barley, sprayed directly over those crops shortly before they're harvested to try to dry them out. It's used to kill weeds in vineyards and orange groves and, you know, almond farms and very ubiquitous. And then outside of agriculture, you know, it's used in golf course management. It's used in forestry management. It's used, I'm sure many of your listeners have a jug of Roundup sitting in their garage. It's, you know, used by cities and counties on parks and playgrounds. It really has become pervasive. The element with with Monsanto and with this chemical was Monsanto always said, you really don't have to worry about it. It's really, really safe. You don't have to go out there with a mask and gloves and, you know, protective gear and boots and everything. And that's why you see people out in their yards just spraying this in shorts and T-shirts and flip-flops, and they don't worry about it. But the science is telling us that you do need to worry about it. And that's, I think, why there's been so much controversy around this chemical.
Recently, some people who had applied a lot of Roundup have turned out to be getting very sick, and some of those people have sought action against Monsanto. You want to tell us about Lee's case first? That was a case last year, right?
Right, yeah. So there are, after the International Agency for Research on Cancer classification of glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen, people did start filing lawsuits. People who suffered from non-Hodgkin lymphoma or the spouse or loved one of someone who had died from it after using Roundup for a long extended period of time. These people filed suits. There are about 11,000 plaintiffs now who have sued Monsanto. The first case to go to trial went last June, and this was Lee Johnson. He was a Benicia County School District groundskeeper in Northern California, and a young guy in his 40s, two little kids, pretty healthy guy. His job was to spray Ranger Pro, a glyphosate-based product sold by Monsanto, around the school grounds almost, you know, every day in warm seasons. And he had a couple accidents, actually, where he was doused in the chemical pretty liberally. And he developed skin lesions and developed a form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that actually manifests in the skin. And it's just an awful thing to see. His entire body, face and eyelids, scalp to the bottom of his feet are covered in these sort of weeping, oozy, awful sores, and the skin just lofts off his body. It's a very painful, painful disease and a terminal one, and he is not expected to live very long. His trial ended in August with a jury verdict of $289 million. The jury found unanimously that Monsanto knew about the risks, the cancer risks, because there was so much science out there indicating there was a cancer causation connection. And importantly, that Monsanto hid that risk, that they worked very diligently, very strategically for many, many years to suppress evidence of a cancer risk. And that case is now on appeal, and Monsanto, on April 23rd, filed its brief with the appellate court in California. So, you know, they're setting up a big battle there, and we'll see how that shakes out.
And so there's still the cases with, you said 11,000, at least 11,000 plaintiffs. So those are people who've gotten sick and who are citing their use of Roundup or other glyphosate products.
Still the spouses. I mean, there are people who have died, and there are cases. Mm-hmm. I write about in my book about Terry McCall. Her husband, Jack McCall, died of non-Hodgkin lymphoma the day after Christmas 2015, and he used Roundup quite liberally on their orchard that they have in Cambria, California, on their beautiful farm there. Used no other pesticide except Roundup because he believed Roundup to be so very, very safe, and developed this rare form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma and very quickly died. And so Terry was one of the first plaintiffs to file suit. She filed suit in early 2016, but has not yet had a day in court.
And then there's another recent court case.
Well, the Edwin Hardeman case ended in March, and that was a man that was in federal court, actually, in California as well, though. And Edwin also had non-Hodgkin lymphoma, although he is in remission, not expected to die anytime soon, hopefully. But again, a unanimous jury came back and awarded him $80 million in damages, and again found that the science showed that this does cause cancer and that Monsanto has known about it and hidden the risk.
So you've been bringing up a lot of scientific research that you've looked into, and I know this is a sticky subject, but just, you know, an internet search of Carrie Gillum turns up a wealth of work that has been done to put out the claim that you're not a scientist, you know, that you're a person who is a writer, but that, so it's pretty impressive how much criticism there is out there, and it's kind of framed as if this is just concerned citizens who are looking at your work with their critical eye, and saying, you know, who is this person accusing this innocent company? It definitely smells like a smear campaign, and memos from Monsanto definitely show that it's a, you know, multi-million dollar campaign to cast doubt on any kind of criticisms of their products. How are you weathering all the criticism that you're dealing with?
You've chosen the least inflammatory thing that they've said about me. I mean, they've also said I'm a Russian operative who is trying to, who needs to be reported to the Department of Justice for being an unregistered foreign agent. That's one. All sorts of things, but I'm in good company because Monsanto's had to turn over roughly 15 million pages of internal communications, and these are emails and reports and strategic plans, as well as text messages, even in which, you know, they talk about a whole array of things, not only the science, but how they're going to combat reporters, scientists, lawmakers, anybody who threatens their profit agenda, anybody who is raising questions or pointing to information about the harm of their product, they're going to go after them. And they talk about this internally. They budget money for it. We know, for instance, the International Agency for Research on Cancer scientists, this is an elite group of independent scientists drawn from around the world. There was one from the EPA. There's one from our National Cancer Institute, from many different countries. People really highly regarded. And Monsanto has spent millions of dollars and lays out internally these strategic plans about how they're going to discredit these cancer scientists. $17 million budgeted in 1 year alone, in 2016, to discredit these cancer scientists and journalists like me to try to counter the scientific information that was coming out. And they do this and they talk about it in their, none of this is sort of just speculation. This is all laid out in their internal documents. They know they can't wage their attacks sort of directly. They know that for them to appear authentic, they have to look like they're coming from independent third parties. They have to look like they're coming from, you know, a science organization or a farm organization. So, for instance, they fund a group called the American Council on Science and Health, which sounds like a wonderful thing.
Sounds legit. Yeah, that's important. Yeah, science and health. I'm all for it.
But you see emails back and forth in which this American Council on Science and Health is saying, here's how much money we need. Can you send us more money, Monsanto? And here, by the way, is what we're doing to help you defend glyphosate. There are many in my book that I laid out. There's many that have come out of the trial. There are numerous front groups that they've set up, numerous academics who they are paying secretly under the table and funneling money through private channels so that it's not publicly reported. It's a very nefarious and secretive strategy. And report, you know, I'm not the only reporter they've gone after. They have a whole website that they've set up with, you know, I'm on there. A couple other reporters from the New York Times are on there. There's a guy from Mother Jones Magazine. Anybody who tries to dig a little too deep, gets a little too close to the truth, gets attacked.
Yeah.
So I think it's a badge of honor, really.
Well, and the, there's the citations are all there. You can find, the facts if you need them. You know, the science is on your side, it looks like. If you look at, one of the people who's read your book and talked about it is a professor and head of cellular neurobiology laboratory at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. And they say that you've assembled the facts and describe how Monsanto and other agricultural companies have lied about their products. So this is, you know, people who are looking at data, looking at science and are you know, they're on board. They understand what you're doing there. It doesn't seem like you're...
I want to make it... it clear, I was asked to speak to the European Parliament, actually, to testify in October 2017 when my book came out. I don't have a position necessarily. Nobody's on my side. I don't take a position on, does this definitively cause cancer? Does it not? Should it be banned? Should it not? That's not my role as a journalist. My role is simply to lay out the facts as demonstrated in data and documents that have been authenticated. And so what we know definitively is that Monsanto has engaged in 40 years of deceptive tactics to try to manipulate the scientific record and try to suppress information about the risk of its products. That cannot be disputed. The cancer science, as with anything, when you try to draw a direct causation between any substance and cancer in real-world exposures in real people, it's incredibly difficult because, of course, you don't put a person in a laboratory cage and monitor them like you do a mouse or a rat or a dog or a rabbit. And we all have different genetic dispositions and different, health vulnerabilities. And so I think it's an incredibly hard task for cancer scientists to really, come up with solid science on this. And our best scientists in the world have said that we need to worry about this chemical. So this isn't my argument or my my position. This is just I'm bringing this information out. And I think that the informed and transparent debate and discussion and public policy moves, require that. You have to have accurate factual information so you can move forward.
Well, tell us about U.S. Right to Know.
U.S. Right to Know, I joined U.S. Right to Know in 2016, left Reuters at the end of 2015, started writing my book in 2016, and went to work for this group. We're a little nonprofit, and all we really do is sort of what journalists are supposed to do, which is we file freedom of information requests and state records requests. So we gather data and documents from our public agencies, taxpayer-funded agencies that pertain to food policy and agriculture, and then we share those with large databases like University of California at San Francisco. They have a big database that is easily searchable for members of the public. We also have our own database on our own website for journalists and consumers, lawmakers, policymakers, anyone who wants to see the truth or get behind the scenes about, where our tax dollars are going and how food policy matters are being handled inside our agencies. We're getting the documents for them. We have thousands of documents from all of these Monsanto trials posted on the U.S. Right to Know website.
All right, and people can check that out by just searching for U.S. Right to Know.
Yep, usrtk.org.
And, of course, people can check out your book, Whitewash, The Story of Weed Killer Cancer and the Corruption of Science. Have you talked to some people in Kansas and Missouri in this area?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got my favorite farmers, who I've come to know over the years. I used to go on the wheat tours every year, which the Wheat Quality Council takes you through hundreds of farm fields every year, reporters and grain handlers and others. And
so having talked to farmers, have you looked into or heard much about the sort of transition that would be required from genetically modified crops so many farmers are dependent on? Is that something that a lot of farmers or agricultural planners are looking into?
Genetically engineered crops, 1990s when I started getting to know this technology and the farmers who were using it. It was, farmers did love Roundup Ready crops. They loved genetically engineered insect-resistant crops and the herbicide-tolerant crops. It made their lives so much easier, and it made it, more efficient for them to manage their fields and manage production. And so you see why they embraced the system. But over time, what has happened is Mother Nature has adapted. Insects are no longer dying when exposed to these insect-resistant crops. Weeds are no longer dying when sprayed with glyphosate herbicides. So the system doesn't work like it used to work. So even if you satisfied health concerns in the field on the farm, the effectiveness is waning. And I've talked to farmers here in Kansas who are still growing genetically engineered crops, but they're also having to till their fields. Well, you know, one of the biggest benefits of genetically engineered crops was the idea that you didn't have to till your field to control weeds. So these farmers are, you know, they're still paying for the premium price seeds, but they're not getting all of the benefit. And to a different, you know, an even worse degree, there are many parts of the country, including in Kansas and Missouri, but maybe more so in the South, in the cotton growing region, where the weeds just, the farmers just don't know what to do with them. They just cannot be killed by glyphosate herbicides at all anymore. And so what Monsanto and the other chemical companies have done is said, well, we're just going to give you new genetically engineered crops, and we're just going to layer on more chemicals, dicamba and 2,4-D, and along with glyphosate. And, of course, agronomists and weed scientists say, well, you're just pushing the problem down the road because now you're going to have weeds that are resistant to all of these things. You just can't be spraying entire fields with these chemicals over and over and over again and not expect Mother Nature to fight back. There are numerous lawsuits all throughout the Midwest now because of dicamba damage that is taking place to certain farmers' fields because of this new Monsanto dicamba strategy. So there are a number of farmers in the Midwest. They call themselves the IDEA Network, IDEA, IDEA, Big Ideas, doing experiments in their fields, really, just trying to grow corn and wheat and soybeans and everything without all these pesticides in a way that still gets them good yields and improves the health of their soil, just much more beneficial for biodiversity, pollinators, and more cost-effective. And they're really coming up with some really interesting strategies, and it involves, you know, crop rotation and cover crops and row spacing, timing of different techniques in the field, and they're documenting this, and they're sharing it with other farmers, and they're getting some research grants, and it's, you know, it's really interesting stuff. So the Green Revolution brought us chemicals and this whole new way of farming, and I think the paradigm is shifting now, and we're moving to yet again a new paradigm.
Yeah, here in the Wheat Belt, we need to be, you know, emphasizing sustainable ways to grow food for ourselves, and this is considered the Grain Belt and the Wheat Belt because it's a great place for growing those things, and we want to maintain that. In the next few weeks, we'll be talking to a wheat farmer, and he's also a sustainable agriculture enthusiast, Jake Johannes, and he'll be telling us about his farm. We do a little farm tour with him, so we'll find out about how he does his grains. But yeah, the IDEA farmers, that's a great movement, and there's you know, plenty more need for that. I think that it's you know, a big part of our economy and a big part of how we get our food. So we need to look to maintaining that and making sure we stay healthy at the same time.
And I do wish, you know, we have an election coming up and people talk about all sorts of issues, and we talk about and we vote on foreign policy, you know, and economic and all sorts of things, but you don't hear people talk enough about food policy. I think what is there that's more important than the food that we feed our families and our kids?
Absolutely, yeah. Amen to that. Well, thank you so much again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
All right, so that was an interview with Carrie Gillum and her book Whitewash. So feel free to check that out and check out more glyphosate news coming up probably next week. We'll be doing another glyphosate show in the very near future, at least, where we interview Anthony Samsel. He's a scientist working on some of the biochemistry of what happens in the body when exposed to glyphosate. And also Jennifer Sass from the National Resource Defense Council. She's a toxicologist studying the different impacts of glyphosate and talking to us about some of the different things that are happening inside of all of our bodies because of this widespread exposure. Just a couple of recent news stories. There's a lot on the horizon in the glyphosate front. In the past week, researchers at WSU in Washington have released a study showing health effects across generations in rats of the chemical glyphosate. Biologist Michael Skinner exposed pregnant rats to the chemical at half the amount expected to show no adverse effect. So it's half the recommended high exposure rate, and no effects were shown in the first generation, but in the second, diseases in the testes, ovary, and mammary glands were found. And in the third generation, they found females had 40% increase in kidney disease and obesity and miscarriages. So that's recent research happening. And in Bonn, Germany, just last Friday, 65% of shareholders of Bayer, the chemical that owns Monsanto, gave a no-confidence vote to their current management board, likely as a result of the $66 billion purchase of Monsanto last year, as Monsanto is currently experiencing 13,400 legal claims against them due to their herbicides. So a lot of news happening. Stay tuned for more of that, and stay tuned for Fiesta Musical coming up in just 10 minutes after EcoRadio's calendar and This Week in Water. Thanks a lot for listening, and stay healthy, everybody.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of April 29th, 2019. Tuesday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza Branch, Kansas City Public Library, KC Parks and Boulevards, The Next 125 Years, presentation by Leon Younger, one of the nation's most accomplished parks and recreation consultants. RSVP at kclibrary.org. He will look at how the system has evolved, assess our capacity to maintain it, and propose some near-term strategies. April 30th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Green for All, Pound Fuel Change Video Launch Party at 31 West 31st, a night of poetry, advocacy, music, and community. Tuesday, April 30th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Thomas Hart Benton Group of Missouri invites you to join at the Missouri Capitol to discuss environment with your legislators. Contact Michael Berg at michael.berg@sierraclub.org or call 314-644-1011. On May 2nd, Green Party KC membership meeting at 7 p.m. at the Westport Presbyterian Church on 201 Westport Road. Learn how local activists and local social movements are developing the power of the people in our electoral system through building the Green Party, an anti-capitalist, eco-socialist political party. On May 4th, from 7:30 to 10 a.m. at Lakeview, 1864 East, 1125 Road in Lawrence, take a guided walk with Molly Zan, KU Associate Professor, observing the birds along the Lakeview shoreline. And on Saturday, May 4th, from 9:30 a.m. until noon, Seed Savers KC at Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center on 4750 Truce. Exchange seeds, bulbs, and plants. These items and more can be found at the KKFI.org EcoRadio KC program page or on our EcoRadio KC Facebook page.
It's migrating trees and beneficial fleas on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's been a rough time recently for those who look to the federal government to protect the country's water quality.
Last week, the EPA announced significantly weakened standards for cleaning up groundwater polluted by PFAS chemicals linked to numerous health conditions, including cancer.
Much of the contamination comes from the military's past use of the chemicals in firefighting foams, and the New York Times reports that the weakened standards come after pressure from the Defense Department.
In addition to diminishing PFAS standards, the Trump administration is moving forward to limit the reach of the Clean Water Act.
During the recently closed comment period on the new rule, which limits the scope of the act, the National Wildlife Federation said that the redefinition could remove protections for as much as 70% of the tributaries and 50% of the wetlands in the continental U.S.
Writing in The Hill, Jim Murphy of the Federation said the new rule ignores basic science that water flows downhill and that pollution upstream ends up in larger rivers. He added that allowing wetlands to be drained for such uses as cornfields or parking lots would mean more pollution, larger floods, and less wildlife habitat.
And lastly, the EPA announced a new interpretation of the Clean Water Act that would exclude regulating pollutants that travel through groundwater before reaching surface waters. As E&E News reports, this could affect protecting waterways from contamination by sources such as coal ash ponds, animal manure lagoons, and sewage systems.
there's much interest in building wind farms off the coast of California, where conditions are different from those in the Atlantic.
Clean Technica reports that generating electricity from wind in the Pacific is not easy because the water is too deep to anchor turbines in the ocean floor. They have to be floated on the surface, which is a major technological challenge.
Nevertheless, 14 companies have told the federal government that they're interested in building floating wind farms, which could possibly begin generating by 2025.
The Department of Energy has been busily preparing for more offshore wind farms in the Atlantic, where it is relatively shallow. But the U.S. has only one commercial facility in operation.
Offshore wind energy is one of the world's most underused resources, according to the Global Wind Energy Council. But it's projected that by 2023, it will account for almost one quarter of the world's wind generation, with three countries, the U.K., Germany, and China, leading the way.
Each day, about one child in every five in the U.S. is not drinking water at all and is instead consuming sodas and sugary beverages.
A new study from researchers at Penn State looked at more than 8,000 youngsters aged 2 to 19. Those who didn't drink water consumed almost 100 calories more a day, which can add up to putting on an extra pound every month.
The lead author said that adding empty calories to children's diets may increase the risk of obesity, diabetes, dental problems, and high cholesterol.
Gizmodo reports that earlier studies have shown that replacing sodas with water can help people reduce their caloric intake, and that making it easier for kids to get water in school can help them lose weight.
The study published in JAMA Pediatrics doesn't explain why so many children fail to drink enough water, but reasons might include concerns about lead contamination or polluted water wells.
There are efforts underway in the U.S. to help forests adapt to a warming world.
The New York Times reports that warmer winters and drier summers have allowed invasive insects and diseases to travel into northern regions of the country, killing trees.
Trees can migrate to cooler climates on their own through seed dispersal, but that takes time. Meanwhile, increasing temperatures could turn some forests into shrubland, so humans are studying whether they can help forests adapt.
Providence Water, the largest provider in Rhode Island, has imported trees far to the south in Maryland to see how they'll do. While some of them have thrived, they attract deer, which eat the saplings.
And in Minnesota, the Forest Service is testing four different approaches to woodland adaptation, which includes importing non-native species from warmer, drier areas.
There's a great amount of uncertainty about these efforts. Anthony Riccardi of McGill University told the Times that these techno-fixes fail to address the cause of the problem, climate change, and that moving tree species is like ecological gambling.
And finally, water fleas. Sounds like something you'd want to avoid if on a lake, but these tiny crustaceans, about the size of a grain of sand, are not only doing us good, they could one day save a life.
Water fleas, or daphnia as they're called, clean fresh water and play a key role in food webs on every continent except Antarctica by eating algae, yeasts, and bacteria.
And because of their diet, they might potentially help researchers develop new medicines. At least that's the hope of Megan Duffy, a researcher at the University of Michigan, who was profiled on the PBS NewsHour last week.
Duffy found that when water fleas are plagued by fungal infections, they avoided the disease when they ate more cyanobacteria rather than their usual fare of more nutritious algae.
The ability of water fleas not to succumb to a fungus has potential for developing medications to fight fungal diseases affecting crops, animals, and humans, which are all on the rise. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a warning this month about a superbug, Candida auris, a drug-resistant fungal infection that's spreading in healthcare facilities, calling it a serious global health threat.
The possibility that water fleas are self-medicating is not unique in the animal kingdom. Mark Hunter, also of the University of Michigan, studies monarch butterflies, which he says protect themselves from parasites by eating toxins in milkweed.
In a university press release, he noted that it's been known that chimpanzees eat medicinal herbs to treat their diseases. And with this discovery about water fleas, the list of animal pharmacists has grown and might contribute to a growing number of medications from which humans can benefit. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.